Hello, my name is May Santiago, and welcome to Second Nature. In today's episode, we are featuring an interview with one of the colloquium speakers from the Cultural Studies Spring 2022 season. On February 17th, Professor Amaka Okuchukwu presented a talk titled Bop and Break, Tracing Black Urban Life in the 20th Century Through a Genealogy of Freddie Brathwaite, Fab Five Freddy. Professor Okuchukwu's work is engaged in research on social movements, race, community studies, public history, and Black archives. She was the 2020 Woodrow Wilson Career Enhancement Fellow and a 2020 African American Digital Humanities Scholar at the University of Maryland, College Park. Her book, To Fulfill These Rights, Political Struggle Over Affirmative Action and Open Admissions, was recognized with the Eduardo Bonilla Silva Outstanding Book Award from the Society for the Study of Social Problems and the Ida B. Wells Barnett Book Award from the Association of Black Sociologists. Her latest digital humanities project, Black Belt Brooklyn, aims to historicize and visualize Black practices of vitality, mutual aid, and institution building in Brooklyn during a period of widespread neglect by formal political institutions at every level. In her talk, Professor Okuchukwu broke down a work-in-progress paper regarding Black cultural production through the genealogy of Fab Five Freddy, an American visual artist, filmmaker, and hip-hop pioneer. In this interview conducted by second-year student Carl Leek, Professor Okuchukwu explains some of her influences, her current object of study, and work she has planned for the future.
In graduate school, Deirdre Royster, who was a sociologist, was my advisor, and I would say my primary interlocutor at that time. But I probably should go back to undergrad, actually. So when I was an undergraduate student, I was part of the McNair program. And as part of that, I engaged in research over the summer. So I was doing ethnography. And that was my first introduction to doing research in that way. And my mentor, Lenita Jacobs, who I believe is still at, she's still at the University of Southern California where I went. She was really influential in mentoring me and exposing me to ethnographic methods. She was a really excellent person to talk through ideas with, and she was incredibly encouraging. And she played a really big role in me deciding to go to graduate school to, at that time, I was thinking I would be an ethnographer. And so, you know, she played a really huge role. And she's an anthropologist, actually. And another really key person whose work I still is hugely influential to me and who continues to model the kind of scholarship, the kind of mentoring, is Robin D.G. Kelly. He was one of my professors in undergrad as well. And he really opened up my eyes in regards to the kind of work that could be done. I had already applied to graduate school by the time I was taking classes with him, but he really stirred something in me in regards to the kinds of classes that I was taking with him. I took Black Movements in America. I took Jazz and the Black Political Imagination, which is very full circle when I've been working on this paper that I presented for the colloquia. Yeah, he continues to be someone that I really look up to and whose work I really appreciate. Graduate school was a very rocky experience for me. I went directly from undergrad into grad school, and, you know, there was a lot about the experience that was just incredibly unsupportive. I don't think I went to the right place. I mean, there's lots of things about it. And so because of that, my experience was in some ways very traumatic. But I will say that, you know, rather than looking to professors, and again, I had, you know, I had some good professors that I looked to still, Ruth Wilson Gilmore, who is a geographer who has been influencing a lot of my understanding of space and was really my first entry point into geography. You know, so, you know, that was really important. One of the best parts about going to NYU for graduate school was that they were in a consortium with other universities in the city. And so I could take classes at other universities, which was really, really important, both in meeting other peers and sort of growing my network, but also, you know, having the experience of, you know, learning from other teachers, right? And so that was really important for me as well. And but I will say that two things were really important to my thinking at that time. So, and that were in some ways outside of the formal space of a classroom. One was being engaged in social movements and social movement organizations, you know, Black nationalist organizations, socialist organizations, and being very engaged in the left in New York. And that is a space where I learned a lot. It influenced the kind of work that I pursued as a graduate student. It influenced my thinking. I found that there was a lot of, like, I found that the conversations and the engagement with theory and literature in these movement spaces was more sophisticated than in the classrooms that I was in, and was way more generous in the sense where many different people from different experiences, backgrounds, and levels of education were participating in those conversations. And it was always in the context of, in some ways, applicability, right? This is about people on the ground thinking about strategy and tactics and those sorts of things. And so that was a really important space for me as a graduate student, and just as a human being, just being engaged in organizations and movements and et cetera. And that really influenced my ideas and influenced some of the questions that I was interested in and those sorts of things. The other element, which is really important, and I sort of mentioned this earlier, was that because I, in part due to the experience I was having in my graduate program, I did a lot to present my work and to meet people outside of my department. And so because of that, I had friends and peers at Columbia and at the Grad Center and at all these other institutions within the city and beyond. And through that, I learned a lot from my peers because I was largely drawing from an interdisciplinary group of people. I'm trained as a sociologist. I was in a sociology program, but I was, you know, my primary writing partner through graduate school, who we wrote our dissertations together. We met weekly. We kept each other accountable and all of that. He was in comparative literature. Another good friend of mine, who is still a good friend of mine, was trained as a historian, but really saw himself in relationship to Black studies, but also space and place, which is a lot of stuff that I'm dealing with right now. He's one of the, you know, if you look to the work being done on Black ecologies right now, he's one of the primary people really establishing that as a field in a way. And so I was really drawing from like this really dynamic interdisciplinary group of largely Black people in the academy, but we were all grad students. We were all trying to find our way. And that was really important in regards to my ideas. And so I will say that while I, again, you know, pursued a PhD in sociology, I always had interdisciplinary interests. I always had questions that could be answered by a variety of methods. And in some ways I felt very constrained by being in a straight discipline. And so at this point in my career, it's been really interesting because I'm kind of pivoting in a sense, right? My first book came out in 2019, which is based on my dissertation and, you know, has done well and it's been great. But you know, the work that I've been engaging with post-book has been much more intentionally, explicitly interdisciplinary. And so for me, it's been a really great experience to allow myself the opportunity to explore interdisciplinary spaces, to explore a variety of methodologies, and to think more critically about space, about time. I've been doing a lot of historical work and about Black communities more specifically and explicitly. I've certainly been in more of an interdisciplinary space as of late, but I've always had these interdisciplinary interests and influences. So many of my mentors and people that I looked to and the people that I was reading were not in my discipline of sociology. So it's always, you know, shaped me.
The second question I have goes more into what your talk was about yesterday. Mm-hmm. And that is, what was the motivation for you to select Freddie Brathwaite as the focus of this development work?
So the initial inspiration in 2015 and 2016, I worked at Weeksville Heritage Center, which is a Black historic site in Brooklyn. It's a museum, it's an archive, and it is a, like I said, a historic site that commemorates the free Black community of Weeksville in Brooklyn. And I was working there as an oral historian and archivist after finishing graduate school in 2015. And I came across, you know, through my work there, I'd come across one, a collection of that Weeksville had done in collaboration with a jazz consortium, a Black jazz consortium in Brooklyn. And it was a collection called the Lost Jazz Shrines of Brooklyn. And it covered the really robust jazz history that existed in the mid-century in Brooklyn and largely concentrated in Bed-Stuy. And I was like, okay, this is cool. You know, I had been going through different interviews as it related to that collection. And I came across an interview that Freddie Brathwaite, Fab Five Freddie, had done that was part of the collection. And I was like, why is Fab Five Freddie in this collection? And I was going through the interview and realizing that he was speaking to a lot of his father's experience growing up in Brooklyn and being part of the jazz scene. And I said, huh, this is really interesting. There's something here. There's something interesting that I want to tease out. But at that time, I just didn't have the time to do it. I knew it was something that I would come back to. I felt that it was really, you know, the jazz history of Brooklyn is very undertold and, you know, people don't really, even in sort of jazz historiography, there just isn't really any attention to it. Actually, Robin Kelly wrote an article in the New York Times that talks a bit about this a couple years ago. So there's that piece of it. But there was also some generational stuff that I still haven't quite teased out that's really interesting to me. I was thinking about movements and music. You know, Fab Five Freddie is one really explicit example when you have him, you know, as I talked about in the presentation, being the sort of first face that a lot of people came to associate with hip hop. And then his father being in the jazz scene, but also being a very active person engaged in movements and things like that in Brooklyn. So I said, okay, there's something interesting here, but it also in some ways echoed other types of relationships that I still have yet to explore, like thinking about the relationship of Black power activists and their children who became hip hop artists. Tupac, of course, everybody knows that story, but, you know, I think every member of the Outlaws, which was his crew, were all the children of revolutionaries. Sonny Carson, who was a sort of a really important local Brooklyn activist and Black power. His son was an ex-Klan. So there's lots of these like really direct connections that were really interesting to me. And again, I haven't even explored those other relationships, but for me, it kind of echoed some similar things. And so I knew that at some point I would come back to it. And so now that I'm past, you know, my first book has come out, I've been exploring more articles and projects as it relates to Brooklyn in particular and Black communities in Brooklyn. And I said, okay, this Fab Five Freddie story isn't going to be in my next book. And so let me try to do an article on it. And so I started, you know, with a paper, which is, you know, still very rough. But working on that paper now, which I presented on. And so that's kind of how I came to it, just finding this oral history interview and then building out, you know, the project over the pandemic, really. Because that's another thing, like, and thinking about research that's possible during the pandemic, right? Not being able to really leave your house and things like that. You know, I was going to archival collections that were digitized. And, you know, like I said, he sent me an audio file, you know, because we couldn't do an in-person interview. We're not in the same location. It was during lockdown. And so I was like, okay, what are some projects that I can work on during the lockdown and quarantine? Because I had done a lot of research between 2015 and 2019, really, that I had just been kind of constantly doing research, and I just had a whole bunch of stuff that I hadn't really been exploring. And I'm just grateful that I did that so that I actually had something to do during lockdown, since I was unable to do all of the research travel that I had planned.
Sort of building on that, what kind of led you to leverage like genealogy specifically in this project? Mm-hmm. Was it like a given because you saw the interview where he was talking about his father, or did you have to kind of, you know, flesh that out some to arrive at that point to use genealogy methods specifically in this project?
To me, there was something interesting about the sort of like this lineage, right? So I had explored this interview. So I knew his father was in this scene. And like I said, had been at Malcolm X. He was there when Malcolm X was assassinated and like those sorts of things. But he also mentions that his grandfather was in UNIA in the interview. And I was like, what? You know, so because I had these sort of facts, I knew that I could, you know, I wanted to confirm them essentially. And I wanted to go back and sort of explore this line. And so I decided to, because it was like these three men in the family, I wanted to see what I could find about these three men in particular, because I knew, again, Rabbi Freddie was very generous to like send me his audio file, but I, you know, we don't have like a relationship. So I knew that I wasn't going to be able to get a lot of time with him. So I knew that I would have to do a lot of research on my own to establish things that I wouldn't be able to tease out of what he's told me if we were like in an in-person interview, right? One of the difficulties of doing a kind of, and it's not really an interview, but when you send someone questions and they send you back an audio file, is that you can't follow up. You can't, you know, you can't, if there are gaps, like you can't sort of interrogate those gaps. Like you just kind of have to deal with what you've been given. And so I knew that I would have to do a lot of work to establish things. Plus there are questions around, and you know, I hate to be like, this is like the sociological, like positivism. There are things about reliability when it comes to a lot of family history stuff too, right? Someone remembers something in some way, may not have happened exactly that way. And so that was another motivation for me to do the genealogy. Because I was like, okay, like if these people perhaps were in leadership roles or, you know, were present in a sort of scene at the time, I should be able to find, like, hopefully I could find some evidence of it, you know? And so that's kind of my approach. I would say also that I was already in a genealogy space because I was doing a lot with my own family genealogy in terms of, you know, trying to trace my grandmother's line, which has been very difficult to do. But, you know, as a side note, my grandfather, this is on my mother's side, my grandfather's line, my aunt in the 90s had done a lot of genealogy research. And this is before Ancestry.com. This is before things were digitized. Like she would get on a plane and go to Louisiana, go to Arkansas, and just be in the archives trying to trace genealogy back. And so my aunt had already done a lot of this work in the 90s. She can trace us back to the first ancestor that was, you know, from Africa, who came over enslaved on my mother's side. And so I had like this family history of, you know, that genealogy work. And so I said, okay, I do have some research skills. And I had done a genealogy workshop actually when I was working at Weeksville. And, you know, I said, okay, let's try to use some of these genealogy skills that I am using to trace my own family history. Like, how can this work in tracing another person's family history? And so, you know, there's lots of questions. I mean, this is another reason why I was, you know, not wanting to post a video of works in progress, because there's a lot of work that you have to do to sort of confirm that those people that are the actual people that you're seeking, right? So Frederick Brathwaite is actually a very common name among West Indian immigrants during that time period. And so, and it's spelled a whole bunch of different ways. And so, you know, and a lot of the spellings don't necessarily indicate that's not that person, because they're just typos and people are spelling things in different ways. And so there's lots of work that has to be done to really make sure that it's the right person. But, you know, so that's how I got into it. And, you know, I just thought that there was something, you know, interesting there. Like, I want to do more to, like, once this paper gets more polished, to, you know, go back and see if I can confirm, just make sure that some of these things are correct. Though I'm pretty sure they are, because there's other, anyway, there's a whole story there. There's ways that I have validated what I found. But yeah, so I just thought the genealogy would be a useful skill. Again, particularly during the pandemic, the availability of digital archival collections, in part because we have ancestry.com and these sorts of things now. So one of the benefits of those things is that it makes wide access to digitized archives available in regards to census information, birth records, immigration records, those sorts of things. And then I just supplemented that with other references, like I said, in Black press, you know. So in terms of looking to, for example, his grandfather's role in like resisting police brutality, like I found evidence of that like in Black press, because people were covering people getting killed by the police and like the mobilizations that were emerging around that.
You mentioned a couple of times yesterday how the literature on social movements is very rigid. Mm-hmm. Can you say more about how this rigidity has been a challenge for your work overall, and ways you've kind of overcame those challenges in terms of applying these canons to aspects of Black social movements?
Yeah, so when I came into graduate school, I thought that I would be doing ethnography, and I thought that I would be sort of focused on social movements. And to be fair, I have been for most of, I mean, that is one thing that is sort of key and central to my research agenda. But through the experience of, you know, doing an exam in social movements and, you know, just, you know, really delving into that literature and trying to write in these social movements, in the field of social movements in sociology, I've just always had problems with it. It's very mechanistic. There are lots of models and essentially like formulas and equations, like this is how we can predict a movement, this is how we can predict what will happen to a movement. And I didn't find that to be useful in any way. I found it to, as I mentioned in the presentation, I found that a lot of these models did not explain anything that had to do with Black communities or Black people in resistance. And I hated reading it. Like it wasn't a pleasurable reading experience in regards to even just the language that was being used to describe and engage social movements. And so, you know, I'm in this weird position where in some ways I feel like I've kind of abandoned that literature and that subfield in sociology and have done like the interdisciplinary space has been much more generative for me in terms of thinking about movement. So that's one thing. And just going outside of that narrow subfield. So going to race, going to urban, going to these other places where I felt like my work would be more well received, because another piece of it is that, you know, because the movement scholarship looks a particular way, sounds a particular way, my work wasn't being engaged in those spaces at all. So my book, To Fulfill These Rights, Political Struggle Over Affirmative Action and Open Admissions, that's a movement's book to me. It's about social movements and political struggles in the title. But Movements People have not engaged my book. The awards that I've received for that book have not been in the social movement space. That book has not been covered in any social movement journals. You know, it's been covered in generalist sociology journals. It's been covered in like education spaces, and you know, which is makes sense, right? The site is higher education, but it's not a higher ed book, you know? So I say that to say movement scholars don't really read my work anyway. And so for me, this space of pivoting and going into interdisciplinary spaces, going to other subfields was much more useful for me in thinking about movements. It provides more space for me to explore how movements manifest in different ways, right? I talked about, right, opening up space for thinking about institution building, and right, how people draw from internal, you know, community resources as elements, important elements to movements, that movements are not always making demands on higher ups. Oftentimes it is about establishing, you know, recognizing that higher ups aren't going to do anything for you and establishing your own spaces and your own institutions, and that being a form of resistance as well. And so, you know, just thinking more broadly about resistance and, you know, engaging scholarship that just helps me think in more generative ways about movement has been incredibly helpful. And I'll say thinking about movements as embedded in a larger context as well, and thinking about, right, this, you know, what is in terms of movements of the Black community, thinking about like where and what the Black community, the larger Black community is doing and thinking and feeling as it relates to these movements as well is really important. And because of that, I feel like I've been leaning much more on, you know, history, Black studies, and just, you know, geography, and thinking more critically about, right, how these other approaches offer something to understanding social movements.
What can you share about the work in progress that you have outside of the work on Fat Five Freddy?
Right. I'm working on another book right now, which really explores social movements. Well, I'll say community organizing, and I'd say more broadly Black social life in Brooklyn during the 1970s and the 1980s. And so I'm looking to what I'm calling Black Brooklyn. I'm looking to that time period in particular because a lot of the literature as it relates to this period, which is called the urban crisis, or is referred to as the urban crisis, in the social sciences, a lot of the literature kind of depicts the community, the Black community, as either all victims to these shifting political and economic conditions, highlights a lot of quote unquote social dysfunction and social disintegration and things like that. And I felt like it was very, the literature was very narrow from living in Brooklyn, from my work in Brooklyn at, you know, Weeksville, also Brooklyn Historical Society. I have been doing oral histories in that community for a long time. And even informally from the relationships that I had with elders, I knew that there was so much activity that just was not covered in any manner. There were like really robust movements and responses to these shifting community conditions. And so I wanted to highlight, you know, agency. I wanted to highlight how people responded to these conditions in a way that wasn't about being victims, you know, to these various forms of crises. And that provided more nuance to this time period, which we often just throw away. And I thought that it was important to add nuance to this period because these are spaces that are currently heavily gentrifying. And so there is, you know, there isn't a sort of historical record, but even in place, like these communities are looking so different. And so I felt like it was really important to highlight what came before and also to provide more attention to the types of efforts that were emerging at that time, because so much of the language about gentrification was about, look at all of these new people that are coming to improve these spaces. Look at all these new people who are coming. There was nothing here before. And there was so much. And so I wanted to talk about the so much, you know, I mean, the amount of stuff, like I'm not even going to be able to cover it all in the book. So that's what I'm focused on now. It's still very much early stages.
Thank you to Professor Okuchukwu and Carl Leek for their time and attention in putting this episode together. Thank you for listening to Second Nature. Special thanks to Allison Landsberg. This episode was edited by May Santiago. Music by Daniel Birch.